Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Sharon, Pennsylvania. After earning degrees from Notre Dame University and Harvard Law School, he taught law at the University of Kentucky, the University of Michigan, and Notre Dame. For 11 years, he was the dean of Boston College's law school, and in 2010, he became the 15th president of the Catholic University of America. The author of 5 books, his name, John Garvey, and we're honored to have him as our guest. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to John Garvey, who a year ago became the 15th president of the Catholic University of America. John, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. It's an honor to be here.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I was one of 8 children born not very long after the Second World War to a father and a mother who'd both grown up in the small town of Sharon, Pennsylvania, in western Pennsylvania. It's a little steel town. At the time, it was about 27,000 people, and today it's only about 15,000, which explains in part why I'm here and not in Sharon. But we had a very happy childhood. My dad was a small-town lawyer, and my mom was a mom. We lived next door to my grandparents. I think often today that it seems almost idyllic. It was such a simpler time in so many ways. And I wonder whether we're just looking with nostalgia on my childhood, but in my conversations with my brothers and sisters, they too remember it as a very happy upbringing.
John, who was the better cook, your mom or your grandmother? Or both?
My grandmother was a terrible cook. In fact, she didn't learn to cook until she was about 60, and she had the advantage of somebody to help her cook in the earlier years when she had all her children, and she maintained in later years that, as she put it, any jackass can cook, but I think she disproved that theory.
What's the biggest thing that mom taught you, and what's the biggest thing that you learned from your dad?
My dad's lessons were things that we appreciated earlier, I think, and that all of us carry through life. Dad saw the world in very clear terms. There was the right thing to do, and there was something that wasn't the right thing to do, and he expected that from all of us, and we internalized his sense of that. So even today, all these years later, I can hear my dad's voice. He, you know, if a question arises, I know what my father will think about it. He was a man of great integrity, and all of us try, with varying degrees of success, to live up to that. My mom, I think, was a time when moms and dads' roles were defined more clearly than they are now. I know that in my own married life and in the lives of our children who are married, we see different patterns working out. But in those days, Dad seemed to speak for the family. We came to realize later, my father died in 1995, I think it was, and my mom lived for 10 years after that, and we all came to realize afterwards that in many ways mother was the strength in the family. My dad, although he'd been a captain in World War II and been through a lot of difficulties, and was the conscience of the family and made the rules and so on, that really he was a marshmallow underneath. And my mother, on the other hand, although she did it in the sweetest possible way, was the backbone of the family and the one who set expectations for her children. So I think I learned from my mom a sense of balance and ambition for things that are important in life.
You got an undergraduate at University of Notre Dame, and then you got a Juris Doctor from Harvard Law School.
Yes.
And eventually, you start teaching law. And you taught law at the University of Kentucky, University of Michigan, and Notre Dame. John Garvey, is there a difference between teaching law at a public university versus a Catholic university?
Well, yeah, the most obvious difference is the one you might suppose. At Notre Dame, I would begin my classes by saying a prayer, and our discussions of a lot of kinds of issues that arose in the course of law classes were infused with religious principles, concerns, interests, presuppositions. Whereas at the University of Kentucky, where I spent about half of my career and 18 very happy years, that's not a part of what you do. You're a public employee, and the Constitution frowns on the idea of government employees teaching people how to pray.
Okay, now for the most important question. As I said, you were at University of Kentucky, Michigan, Notre Dame, and also the dean of Boston College Law. John Garvey, what college football and basketball team do you root for?
Well, I assume that you're talking about Division III, and in both of those sports, I root for the Catholic University of America's Cardinals. They're my favorite team in all sports.
Spoken as a true lawyer. So.
Not just a lawyer. This is really a wonderful university. It's my first experience of Division III sports. The other schools where I've worked all have Division I teams, and some of them, like Kentucky's basketball team this year, are pretty good teams. So I do follow and cheer for Kentucky's basketball team, and I would root for them in almost any game except if they were to be playing Catholic University, which hasn't happened so far.
Other than in capability, is there other differences between Division III and Division I sports?
Yeah, actually, there's some of the things that lead me to love Division III sports. At Catholic University, we've got two dozen varsity athletics teams, and our athletes, maybe north of 20% of our freshman class will be varsity athletes, and the athletes at Catholic University have a higher retention rate, a higher graduation rate, and a higher grade point average than the rest of the student body. Our athletes are our best students. Whereas at Division I schools, you're always worried about some wide receiver or running back or basketball player getting into trouble or not keeping up his or her grades. And that's just not a concern for us. It's really an opportunity for students who are primarily interested in their academics but who love to play sports and are pretty good at it to do both those things.
We're talking to John Garvey, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krasula, and we're with John Garvey, the author of five books and the president of Catholic University of America. John, you were named the 15th president of Catholic University in 2010. Tell us, if you will, about the Catholic University of America.
Well, thank you for asking. This is, as you mentioned, not my first job. I've taught at a number of schools, but I have to say that this is the best job I have ever had, and it's in large part because the Catholic University of America is such a wonderful university. It's celebrating this year its 125th anniversary. In fact, on April 10th, we're gonna have the official celebration, but we've been having an extended party the entire year. It was begun in the last part of the 19th century. After you might remember that there were a number of plenary councils in Baltimore of the American Catholic bishops, and the second Baltimore council, which paid attention to a lot of issues of both elementary and secondary and higher education, decided that there ought to be a university, but they didn't actually pull the trigger on it. The third Baltimore council decided to create a university where, at that time, mostly clergy in the Catholic Church would be able to get what they then called a higher education. They meant graduate education, because clergy would have received the equivalent of a college degree education in the seminary. But not many American universities, not the Ivy League universities in those days, gave PhDs. The first American university to pay attention to that in the European way was Johns Hopkins, which is just 10 years older than us and right up the road in Baltimore. So when this university was begun in 1887, we had in mind Johns Hopkins on the domestic front, or the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium, or the German research universities, a place that gave graduate education and PhDs in the kinds of subjects that you might suppose Catholic clergy would be interested in: philosophy, theology, canon law, Semitics, Greek and Latin classics of that kind, and other arts and sciences, mostly arts courses. So that's how we began as a graduate school. And we didn't first admit undergraduates until 1904, but we've had our doors open to undergraduates now for 108 years. It was begun in one.
This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Frasulla, and we're with John Garvey, President, Catholic University of America. John, kids today, young people today, phenomenal challenge they have trying to traverse life's landmines out there. And one thing I hear from a lot of great parents, they refer to one of their kids as their prodigal son, their prodigal daughter, who's all messed up. What do you say to those parents?
Well, one thing that I have to say is that is not a new phenomenon. The lesson of the prodigal son is a couple of thousand years old, so there were prodigal sons back then, too. I don't think that that's a new thing. And the prodigal son came home in the end and sorted his life out, and his parents continued to love him during his prodigal years. So two of the lessons we learned from the gospel story are, number one, that you're not alone in having this experience, and number two, the most important thing is to keep loving your son or daughter and pointing them in the right direction, and they'll come home in the end. I do think, however, that young people today face a set of challenges that are different from what I described as my own almost idyllic childhood more than 50 years ago in Pennsylvania. In those days, if you wanted to get in trouble, what you did was drink beer, and you didn't really dare do that until you were in your late teens, and you snuck some beers when you were in high school. It's hard, unless you get behind the wheel of a car, to do really serious harm to yourself drinking beer, because you have to drink so much of it that you get sick before you before you get into trouble. On the other hand, there are drugs nowadays that can mess anybody up in a very short time and cause them to do really serious harm, and that's just a change in the kind of trouble that offers itself. The same is true. In another part of my life, I'm still a teacher. I teach a course in the politics department, in the last month we've been teaching about free speech issues, one of which is pornography. And what I was saying to my class about pornography was, 100 years ago, pornography was something in leather-bound books that were kept in gentlemen's clubs, and people couldn't get their hands on them. Nowadays, any 10-year-old messing around with a computer can get the most awful kinds of things just at the click of a mouse. So it offers itself in the same way that drugs do to young people nowadays. And the culture has made these kinds of things, maybe because they're more available, more acceptable, or maybe it's the other way around. In any case, there are opportunities like that to become a prodigal son or daughter that are much easier to find than they were 50 years ago, and that's a really tough challenge for young people to deal with. I feel a lot of compassion for them, just because the world they are growing up in is difficult in ways like that, that ours was not.
A lot of parents lament about the texting today. You know, they can't get their kid to talk to each other. What's your feelings about texting?
I'm not sure how to do it myself. My children sometimes send me texts, and I'll have to call them on the phone and have them explain to me how to get the text. So, I'm not a big fan of it. Although I'm not a Luddite, and a lot of forms of communication I think are really wonderful. Texting is not one of mine, but Skyping is. One of our daughters lives in London, and phone calls to London are really difficult, and she's got children, so we can get them on my computer screen. Another of our daughters lives in Seattle. One of our boys lives in Cupertino, California. And another of our daughters lives in South Bend, Indiana. And I can just click on the bottom of my screen and call one of them up and look at them while I'm talking to them, and for free. So I love that. Jeannie and I don't do Facebook. The kids say it would creep them out if we did that. But I find that they keep in close touch with one another and share pictures and that sort of thing by corresponding through Facebook. So I'm in favor of those kinds of things. The one thing, I had a really interesting talk with one of my nephews about Facebook, and he said the thing that bothered him about Facebook was that it presented you with an opportunity to pretend that you were someone that you really weren't, you know, to create a false identity for yourself online as a way of presenting yourself. And that wasn't necessarily a good thing, you know, to live a life that isn't true to yourself. But that's something that I think the people who are on Facebook are in charge of.
We met a few months ago at a dinner in Bloomfield, and you were the speaker, and that night you talked about the respect for religious freedom. And also on February 19th, you wrote an article, an editorial for the Chicago Tribune entitled Religious Liberty with a question mark. Talk to us, if you will, about your concerns about religious freedom today.
It's a serious concern in a new kind of way, I think. I think one of the great successes of the American political experiment is the way we have dealt with the role of religion in this country. We are not, as many of the Western European countries from which our first settlers came, we are not a country that has had an established church. In fact, well, some of the colonies had established churches, but when we began under our present constitution, we decided that religion was not something that should be the business of government. Not because religion was bad for government necessarily, but because government was a very bad thing for religion. If religion is supported by the government, then it tends not to fend for itself, and people tend to think that it's the government's business to take care of and not their own concern. I think you'll find that rates of church attendance in countries that once had established churches or still do are much lower than they are in the United States. So I think that that's something we have for a couple hundred years done very well. In recent years, there have been two kinds of changes that have been matters for concern. One is that in 1990, the Supreme Court said that it was no longer going to be the government body that was in charge of enforcing rules of religious freedom, at least in cases where the government wasn't just out to get religion. But if government, the government made rules that applied to everybody equally, the court said it would have nothing to say about them, even though they fell very harshly on religion. So, for example, if the government wanted to, it could pass a law saying nobody was allowed to consume alcohol. It's not going to do this. We tried this experiment, and it didn't work. But if the government wanted to reinstitute prohibition, it could do that, and it could apply the rule to Catholics, Episcopalians, Jews, and other people who consume wine in their sacraments. It could forbid the use of sacramental wine. So that's one change. The Supreme Court, in this case that I'm referring to in 1990, said that we didn't really need to worry because the elected branches of government in a country like the United States would be very solicitous of the religious practices of its citizens. And for much of our history, that's been true. I think that the Congress itself in particular has paid close attention to people's religious concerns. And if the Supreme Court says, as it once did, that the armed services could tell Orthodox Jews serving in the army to take off their yarmulkes, Congress passed a law saying, no, actually, that's all right. You can wear a head covering or other religious garb so long as it's neat and doesn't detract from the uniform. Or in the case that I was referring to from 1990, the Supreme Court said that the state of Oregon could forbid consumption of peyote by Native Americans. Congress responded by passing the American Indian Religious Freedom Act, and then by passing something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, aimed at undoing the 1990 decision. So Congress has been very good. On the other hand, in the last year or so, a number of federal agencies, the Department of Health and Human Services, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the Department of Justice, the National Labor Relations Board, have made a number of rules that have, I think, interfered in ways that that concern us with the religious freedom of universities or of individual Americans. And so I think I don't know whether this is a harbinger of things to come or whether this is a temporary phase that we're going through, but I think there's reason to be concerned about religious freedom in America today.
We're talking to John Garvey, and I'm Jack Quasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Quasula, and this is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to John Garvey, President, Catholic University of America. John, on January 20th, the Department of HHS made an announcement, a ruling, that riled a lot of people in America. And then on February 10th, they modified that ruling. What's your thoughts on the modification of that ruling?
You're referring to a decision by the Department of Health and Human Services on January 20th that required many religious institutions, Catholic and not, to provide at no additional cost to their subscribers all forms of FDA-approved contraceptives, including contraceptives that act after fertilization to induce abortions, and also to provide surgical sterilizations to all of the subscribers of their healthcare plans. So in the case of a university like ours, this rule applies to our students, to our undergraduates, as well as to our faculty and staff. It says that we have to provide free contraceptive coverage and early stage abortion coverage to our students. This is a matter of real concern for us, as you might imagine. On February 10th, the president announced that he had a new proposal. He said, you Catholic schools that are concerned about this and other religious institutions, don't worry about it. We're going to order insurance companies to provide these services to the employees and students at no added cost. The proposal that the president has offered hasn't yet, so far as I know, been made effective in a regulation, so it's still a proposal. But it doesn't really change the situation in any way. Imagine that under the new proposal, one of our undergraduates goes to the local CVS pharmacy to buy contraceptives. The CVS pharmacy will then apply to our insurance company for reimbursement, and our insurance company will turn around and charge us for the contraceptives that she purchased. So there's no financial difference between the January 20th proposal and the February 10th proposal, other than that the announcement about the availability of contraceptives to our students and our employees is one that's made by the insurance company rather than by us. Apart from that, it doesn't change anything.
In an earlier segment, you talked about church attendance going down in Europe. It seems to me church attendance is going down in this country as well. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a real matter of concern. There's a very interesting recent book by Charles Murray called Coming Apart about the decline in what he calls founding virtues among Americans. He speaks about family life and religion, industry and honesty. And he points to some very disturbing data about church attendance among Americans, the slope of that graph is going down at a fairly rapid rate, at least among the people we traditionally survey. If you look at the Catholic population, it actually breaks up. These are not Murray's data, but I've seen these data reported elsewhere. Among American Catholics, you'll find that Hispanic and Latino Catholics, who now make up 40% and will soon be the majority of the American Catholic population, church attendance is much higher than it is among white Catholics. So this is not a simple phenomenon. It's complex. But it's a matter of real concern. First of all, because if Catholics believe that our own life of faith is, or that we're here on earth to know, love, and serve God and in this world and be happy with him in the next, and we've stopped paying attention to that, then we've lost the most important thing in life. Second, it's a matter of concern in debates like the ones we're currently having about religious freedom, because I think that, as the Supreme Court observed, a country whose people care about religion are going to care about the freedom of religion. But if we lose our concern about religion itself, then religious freedom is going to be in danger as well. I worry that might be one of the things that's behind the recent spate of activities that I pointed to.
As our time winds down together tonight, John Garvey, could you lead us or leave us with some advice to our young listeners?
I'd be happy to, especially because my job is being concerned about young people. I think it's important for young people, first of all, to follow their own heart, to pursue their own dreams as they have always done. It's when you're young, it's one of the great gifts that the young give to the rest of us is ambition for wonderful things. I had a wonderful trip to World Youth Day with a group of our students last summer, and I have to say it was the most wonderful thing for my own faith to serve, to perceive the faith of these young people. It inspired me to see what they were hoping for. So that's one thing. The second thing is, it's really important to work hard. People are successful in life partly with the gifts that God gave them and partly through their own efforts. And the people who succeed in school, including in university and in later life, are the ones who work really hard. Those are the kind of people that I love to meet, because they really care about things and they put their hearts and souls into their work. So love God and work hard.
John Garvey, what a shining example of a man of principle. Thanks much for sharing your amazing story. Keep up the great, great work.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Jack.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom.